These are the moments we all live for. How many times have we seen these three work together? Elma Smith out of Africa, straight into the biltong shops of Southwest London. Emily Scarrett, Scazzy Das. Surely you can never run a switch too many times. And Mo Hunt, chippy, snipey, sporty, karaoke. Sounds like the new Spice Girls. Here they come, the good, the Scazz, the rugby.
Welcome to The Good, the Scazz and the Rugby, brought to you by our friends from Vodafone. Shoo-loo-loo, it was a party for the ages over the weekend. What a great day out at Twickenham. If you joined us at the Cabbage Patch for The Good, the Scazz and the Rugby live with our steering wheel, our fourth wheel. No, so are we going with steering wheel?
You had to go there, didn't you? It's not even on the script today.
Katie Daly-McLean, it's good to see you again.
I've missed you.
I've missed you so much. It's really nice to be able to turn my head again. I had a really good time on Saturday. It was like my personal New Year's Eve party. And I at one point was rocking out so hard that I needed muscle relaxants on Sunday because I was headbanging. And I would 10 out of 10 not recommend doing this to myself ever again. So that was great times. Outside of that, there was a good bit of rugby that was played. And we are joined by BBC's rugby reporter and commentator, the first woman to commentate on a men's international in the UK, Sara Orchard.
Hello, thank you for having me again.
Well, she was one of the OGs. She joined us on season one.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's very lovely to be back. And I have to say, you've come a long way since Zoom. This is very impressive.
I mean,
I like it in here. It's
we
comfy.
Even have pictures of everyone here around us and a little kitty cat on the shelf, you know, priorities.
Yeah, very nice.
And alongside the three of us, the woman who we all look to so often when we don't have the answer. Honestly, it feels like sometimes she's the conscience of the women's rugby space. She found Scrum Queens, the OG women's rugby website and publisher back in 2009. And these days she's the CEO of More Than Equal, which aims to find and develop the first female Formula One world champion. Nothing major. Ali Donnelly, you do love a challenge. Hey.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. This is my debut, so very happy to be here.
It's taken us a very long time to work up to this because when you invite Ali Donnelly down, you need to make sure you've got your house in order. You need to make sure that you're ready to have the conversations because she's going to speak truth to power, even though she is the power.
No pressure. I better say some controversial things today. Mm.
But just to add to what Elma said there, women's rugby and the place it's in now, we just have to say, we wouldn't even have world rankings. I mean, someone might have caught up eventually, but you were the pioneer. You and John Birch, I have to give him his credit as well here, because without Scrum Queens, just the data would be so far behind where it is. So, yeah, big up your big self.
And I think as a player, it's even more important because nobody was interested. So for me, looking back on my career, if it wasn't for the likes, like you say, of you and John, it wouldn't exist. It just, nobody took any interest in it. So I think there is a lot that we can be grateful to the things that you did in our game for.
I'm really uncomfortable compliments, so this is awful.
So must we stop
now? Thank you so much.
Move on, you're a great friend. You're a wonderful mother. Such a good chief executive of any company.
Speaking of great friends, Katie Daly-McLean, are you and Sara Orchard the besties of the best friends of the women's rugby industry? Because you've just spent 5 weeks in each other's company virtually non-stop.
I think so. I'm not sure if Sara would agree.
Oh.
But on this, I don't know if Sara knew that me and you had a massive fallout.
When?
2014.
Oh, yeah. So I remember that very well. I blame Gary for that, but carry on. You can tell the story.
So me and Sara had a big fallout that I maybe held on to for around 3 to 4 years. Nothing.
Doesn't hold a grudge.
Nothing major.
3 to 4 years.
I really want to know what happened.
Roughly.
What did she do? What did you do?
I'll tell the story. 2014 Rugby World Cup. Is it ahead of the Canada game?
So it was the opener.
The opening game. Gary Street does not play Katie Daly-McLean. Kerry Large is named as the starting fly half. And in a press conference, if anyone doesn't know, first thing you do is you ask coach, any injuries? Nope. No injuries. So no injuries. Katie Daly-McLean not injured? Nope. So headline BBC website, Katie Daly-McLean, England captain, dropped.
That's a huge scoop. That's a story right there.
Right there. But I was furious.
At the time.
Why were you furious?
Well, because Katie took it as like she wasn't actually dropped at all. She had an injury, but they were trying to hide it. So it's an insult that she was dropped. So all I was doing was conveying information. And I think it was after the semi-final. I had to say something to you along the lines of, we were in a, like a mix zone, which is like after, so we're at Stade Jambouin, you've just beaten
Ireland
in the mix zone, and I'm there and I'm going, Katie comes along the line, I can see she does not want to talk to me at all. She gets to me, and I think she stands in front of me like this.
Arms crossed.
Like this. And I said,
sulking.
Exactly.
Oh, and I did sulk back
you
then.
You really did. And I said to her, I said, so, Katie, congratulations on the win. We all know now that you were not injured. They were covering it up. And she sort of goes, yes.
You were not dropped. You were injured. Exactly. They were covering it up.
Exactly.
But what did you want Sara to do?
I'm not sure at that point, but I held on to it for a very long time and it was furious. I think as well, in the context being that we hadn't had a lot, there wasn't a lot of press around women's rugby. This was, for me,
very
it was definitely very, very new, never about single players or even the team up until that point. So for this to come out, and obviously, you know, now as a grown up and being able to look back and reflect. So I was just doing her job. But for me at that point, I felt personally insulted. It was like, she's deliberately gone after me and tried to ruin my rugby career. Obviously, I mean, she didn't have the full story. So you can kind of understand. But yeah, didn't speak to Sara for a long time. And now we're best friends.
Exactly. I'm pretty sure that that would have been one of the articles that was pinned on the 2014 wall at the time that inspired me to go and win the thing. So, there you go. What can I say?
Yeah. She motivated you, Katie. She was the fuel.
That was after I'd stopped sobbing to Skaz in my bedroom that everybody thinks I've been dropped.
Oh my gosh.
But this is where it's multi-led. But as you say, how far have we come since those kind of days? Because you go back to 2014, I was out at that World Cup. Sarah Mockford from Rugby World was out at that World Cup. Obviously, Scrum Queens were there.
Obviously, Ali was
there. I can't really remember many other press. I remember us coming to the final.
There were very few there for the entirety. I think that's right. Yeah. And I think even the 2010 World Cup, everybody came to the Stoop for the final. But in you know, the hardcores out in Guildford, I mean, there'd be two or three of us. Mm. So it's come a hell of a long way. So you're right, the scrutiny that players are just not used to it.
Yeah. 48,778 fans, people in that stadium. And there was just so much around that day that I absolutely loved. We have to roll back to the Scarrets on the stage at the live show. If you did miss the live show at the Cabbage Patch, you missed out on the Scarrets just telling us who their favorite Red Rose outside of Skazzy was. It wasn't you. Sorry, Katie.
No, it was Mo.
It was Mo. It was Mo.
This is why I'm the fourth wheel. The one on the back of the Land Rover. Dragged along.
And then there was a big celebration after the match. You attended that, right, Ali, of the 2014 and the 94 winners. Loads of people, little reunion.
Yeah, it was like the ghosts of women's rugby past walking into the patch later on, to be honest. Anyone I've ever met from rugby was there. In fact, I was like dodging people at one point because, you know, you have the same kind of conversations. But no, it was a great day.
You blocked me for 3 years.
Yeah, we were there right till the end, you and I, so we're fine. No, it was a brilliant day. I mean, of all of us, I was in the crowd as a fan for the first time in a long time at a women's rugby game. There was 20, 25 of us in a big group, kids, friends, family. If you forgot, as an Irish person, what was happening on the field, it was brilliant, wasn't it? It was really celebratory. The vibe was fun and the aftermath, brilliant.
What was the experience like in the commentary box? How did that compare?
I think each year it's getting better. It's not comparable to a men's international in any way, shape or form, because it's such a different crowd that come to these women's occasions. They're there for a very different feeling. And actually, it reminded me a little bit of Ali and I did an event a few weeks ago that had Carly Telford there, where she told this story about a Chelsea women's match where Arsenal turned up with the wrong socks. And so the whole match was delayed by half an hour. And she said, if that happened at a men's game, can you imagine the crowd waiting for half an hour for a match to start and the problems that would cause? She said the DJ just played out a load of bangers, a load of ABBA music.
I was there. It was amazing. It was all like 90s classics.
Yeah.
So obviously in your 40s, absolutely loving it. But it wouldn't have happened in a men's game.
But that is the point, is that when you go to a women's game, there is that goodwill, that want to be there, that atmosphere that you are there for a good time. And that's not to say that in any way the rugby is incidental, in any way, shape or form. Mm. But it's perhaps not quite the genesis of what people are actually going there for. And that does make it a very joyous occasion to attend.
Mm. I was sending someone a video. I literally, at halftime during the Sophie Ellis-Bextor set, was just standing filming the people people in the stands and how many people stayed in their seat at halftime, considering the size of the average female bladder, I was very impressed.
Yeah.
All of us were still in our seats and everyone was dancing, and the atmosphere at halftime, I think Sophie was a great win. Yeah. She was just absolutely sensational. The music landed for everyone. Little bit of disco, little bit of sequins, bit of fun. And then even when she came off the pitch and she walked around, you could just see the fans, you know, really everyone pushing to the front, trying to wave at her and get cracking a slice of her attention. Oh, so good.
She was absolutely amazing. And did you see the guy at the end of the pitch behind the girls who was doing the flips on the bouncy shoes?
Yeah, that was right in front of us. It was brilliant. Wow. Yeah.
So good, so good.
There was a group of like burly men in front of us, and they stayed sitting for the whole game, which is great because we had small kids with us. But when Sophie Ellis-Bextor came on, like, they just, up they got. Oh. I mean, what was the one? Groove Jets?
Groove
is that
Jets,
the one?
Yeah.
I mean, they lost their minds. It was amazing. It was so fun.
Can I just rewind and go back to 94, 2014? Mm. That's right. There we go. Get my numbers right way around. Because I always say to Katie and Ali, I really try and not to fangirl at all around rugby, because as a journalist, you're a very sensible, serious person.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't fangirling, but I did have a big moment when I went into this big event that was laid on at Twickenham, where I have never met Karen Almond. I've never met her. She lives on the other side of the world and people don't know the name. She's Red Rose number one. She was the captain at the World Cup in 94. I've never seen her. And I was looking around this room and I was going, I know she's in here. And I was like, can someone please just like point her out to me? And then I saw her, I was like, okay, that's Karen Almond. And then I was just like, that's Karen Almond, Red Rose number one, who won the World Cup, lifted it in 94. That's Katie Daly McLean, who lifted the World Cup in 2014. And you turned around to me and you said you'd never met her except on a Zoom. So I was like, right. So I got the two of them together and I was just like, how amazing is this moment? And we got a lovely picture of the two of you together.
We did. I'm really grateful. And just what an amazing person she was, you know, the background, the era. When you listen to the pioneers and their stories, if they hadn't done what they did in 94, so they started teams in London after finishing university, we wouldn't be here. None of us would be sitting talking about our game now. And I think, we don't forget it because it is celebrated, but I just think when you get the opportunity to have a one-on-one chat with people who played in such a different era, even though it was only 30 years ago, it's still amazing.
Did you meet Karen?
Yeah, I've spoken to Karen. She was actually in the patch later on.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Sort of
that's
different
not
vibe.
Surprising.
But I think the shame is, of course, we have no footage from that era, not much of it, mm-hmm. A little bit of footage here and there. Because when I was researching my book, I remember, you know, asking players about her and everybody would say she was unbelievable. And I would love to have seen her play. You know, if you talk to people from that era, who's the best player in that era? Karen Almond. A couple of Kiwis as well. But yeah, she's up there, isn't she?
She was saying, and she was really polite. She was like, her dad watches the game now and occasionally speaks to her in New Zealand. It was like, you would have fitted in the way you play now in the current era. She wanted to kick a ball, which now, look, a lot of the girls can kick a ball. But even we know 10 years ago, so never mind 30 years ago. And he said, yeah, to her that she would have fitted in the game today, which I think is a massive compliment of the type of player that you're talking about.
Yeah, and the stature, but also the contribution that she made. Brian Moore wrote in The Telegraph, several of the Red Roses' tries were not taken as a result of egregious failings. That is definitely not the word that I would have used, but it's a very good one. From the Irish team, several were superbly crafted and executed. This was especially so when it came to working out how to find the edge of a defence and exploit the outside centre/fullback channel, the most difficult area to defend in rugby. Is the display, and as you say, like the amount of things that players just tried and just gave a go on Saturday, is this the John Mitchell era kicking in?
I think this is a really fascinating one because I don't think this is necessarily John Mitchell. I think this is what's come before him. I think this is the Simon Middleton finer detail, the Scott Beaman, the Gary Street, and he's just getting some of the rewards of it. Because if you look at some of the running lines and some of the damage England did from first phase alone, that's not something I think you can fix in 6 weeks. I think Lou Meadows has obviously come in and made a real big emphasis on the attack. And I think she hasn't necessarily change the attack on the field. It's the mentality of the girls. It's how brave they are, how much they want to try, how much they want to explore. And I think some of the, you look at it with Eddie Jones and Stuart Lancaster. I think some of the bits of Eddie in his beginning tenure was the result of the work Stuart Lancaster had done before that. And I think Mitch is reaping rewards, the quality of player. But I think for me, it's the mentality of England, the way they want to play, their ability to keep the ball alive. And some of their first phase was absolutely sublime on Saturday.
I do agree with you, but then I also have to say, I have never seen England attack like this. And I do think John Mitchell has had an impact. Now, I don't know if it's just that they've been given the freedom and the license that they are allowed to, that I do look back at the Middleton era and you see the great things that they did, but you look where those tries came from in that period. I mean, Katie, let's face it, we did get fed up of talking about tries coming off the back of Mauls. You do just look at their ability. I mean, Tatiana Hurd arguably is one of the unsung women of that squad right now because she just stands there. She distributes so quickly, allows Holly to offer herself as an extra player in that backfield. It really is great. And I just haven't seen it before. So I do think John Mitchell has had a bigger ability to actually free them up.
The person we haven't mentioned is Brian Ashton. And, you know, I spent a bit of time, a good hour and a half on Wednesday night talking to Lou Meadows. I've known Lou quite a long time. And so we were doing an interview, but we had a good chat in and around it. And I think I didn't understand how much of a role he was playing. So he's in around the squad a lot. He's definitely mentoring her and helping her as an up and coming high potential attack coach. So, you know, Abby Dow talked to Fee Thomas about it after the game too, his impact. And, you know, he is the guru of attacking rugby in this country, isn't he? He's the kind of Wayne Smith of the RFU's kind of ecosystem. So I suspect there's an element of truth to everything everyone is saying, and he is adding to that in a way that maybe we didn't realise until recently.
I'm going to literally read from that story that Fee wrote because it's so poetic. The way he phrases, these are Abby Dow's words, the way he phrases it almost makes you rethink the philosophy of rugby. I think the English brand, the philosophy is, let's kick to the corner, let's take the territory. But is that the philosophy of all rugby? Can we expand that? The questions we've been asked, you can see our nines and tens are stepping up and actually answering those questions and as a result, playing a really exciting brand of rugby. And that is what I have felt. I have felt that the Red Roses now are stepping into an era where they're not playing the kind of rugby we've seen and come to expect and know. It's really surprising and quite delightful.
The other thing I would add on to that and on Abby Dow is the improvement in Abby's game. So I think you've always need England's 9 and 10s have always been the ones that dictate everything, all the hand and skill. But if you look at Jess Bruce's Breach's involvement, Abby's involvement, coming into that 13 channel, which is generally your highest pressure because you're going to get the most amount of heat from defence. I thought some of her decisions to run and pass were amazing. And I think that probably links into how she, as a winger, is viewing her own responsibility in England's attack. It's not just about finishing now.
And to credit someone who I know sits regularly on this sofa, Natasha Hunt, Mo, I'm BBC trained. I have to call her Natasha Hunt and Emily Scarrett.
It's so
Scarrett,
beautiful
just so you
that
know.
You go for the full name.
I'm just so well trained. We don't do nicknames. I know. Something you learn in commentary. Natasha Hunt, I can see now when she was playing in the Middleton era, you could tell she wasn't always in favour. Ultimately, the style of rugby they played did not suit her at all. And whatever happened in that era happened. You can see in this Mitchell era how much it suits her. Mm. Her freedom to express herself, to get that ball moving, it is just so designed for her. Mm. And as it stands right now, for me, she would be a starter in a World Cup final quite easily. I hope, you know, her body allows her to get that far. But the way she's playing right now, it's just incredible.
It's just great.
Can I just add, though, to Brian Moore's thing? Some of the England attack was in large part due to some failings in our defence, to be fair. So we should talk about that later. It was beautiful how England played this intricate style of kind of coming out the back, as you described with Hurd at first receiver is great, but there were some basic kind of fundamentals that fell apart for Ireland as a result of being overwhelmed, I think, by the way in which England was playing. So, 90% of the credit due to England, but I think there were some things that could have been better from Ireland.
We definitely want to get into that. I just want to say our Mo made it into the Katie Daly McLean team of the week.
Thank goodness. A lot of pressure was building about
that. There was some pressure around that. And I love when we posted the score, how many people got stuck in the comment section on our Instagram. And I just want to credit a few of them. Michelle said, what a fantastic day of rugby. And to be able to see both Hunty and Scazzy on the pitch, fantastic. And Mo's try was the highlight of my day. Mm-hmm. Crazy Roop said, how many times has Mo Hunt outscored Scaz in a match? We'll leave that to Scrum Queens to tally up for us. I have no idea. John Marley Giggers said, so chuffed. At last I got to see Scaz live. A hell of a pass for Maddie's try. Hunty, brilliant game as always. Well done, ladies. Might catch the crew in Cabbage Patch shortly. Well, yes, you did. We put on a bit of a show. Scazzy's return and that little outside kick that she put in to set up that try, she said, and this is the most Emily Scarrett reply. So I saw that and I thought, if I had done that and someone said to me, reflect on that moment, I would have just gone, oh, how exciting, how fun, tried something, it came off, yay, we scored, boom.
Mic drop.
She goes, if I had a left foot, it wouldn't have looked quite as dramatic. I've only got a right foot, so I had to try and kick it off the outside of the boot. The girls outside of me were screaming for it, so I thought if I don't try to put it along the ground somehow, they're going to be so mad.
So mad.
So mad.
Looks so good. Really did.
It was beautiful.
It's true, though. She doesn't have a left foot.
There we go. So how good to see the contribution. And oh, we FaceTimed her from the pub. I do have a screen grab of this. We wanted to convince her to come out. And she was like, no, the job's not done yet. But it was really good. We did also level a fair bit of reality check chat after the Italy game at her. So we now have to give her her flowers. I mean, she does have a name in the title of this podcast.
Do you know what? It's really awkward talking about Emily Scarrett, Scaz, whatever you want to call her,
yeah.
When her name is in this podcast. And I do think this is a really tough time for her as a player. You know, she's 34 years old. She has been regarded as the best player on the planet for women. And to get to that next World Cup with the injuries that she has had, I think, I'm not going to say anything I haven't said to Katie, it is all about managing her body now and understanding, particularly with her playing 12, what her body can and can't do, how much she actually needs to train anymore. I think that's going to have to be tapered perhaps a little bit. Is that fair to say, Katie?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think for Scazzy, that the best bit isn't it? We know she can play. We know she can ball. We know she can kick. Actually, she doesn't look particularly out of place in that 12 shirt. No. I was a massive skeptic of it. I think having played alongside her, I think she is a very, very good 13, but she is looking pretty comfortable there. I think, like you say, it's going to be very, very different or very interesting how she views where she wants to be. Does she want to go and say, look, I want to be a starter for England and I'm going to do everything in my power? Or is she going to have to just try and navigate this next section of our career, because ultimately our careers are in sections, aren't they? You can't be, she won't be what she was when she was 17, what she is now at 34, but the things she can do and the way she can play. And I think it's going to be an interesting review for her to look back on this tournament and think, actually, look, what's next for me? How am I going to feel about it? Where do I sit? What do I want?
Can you imagine being Ireland though?
Want her coming on.
And then she comes off the bench and you're already so far behind.
I'd have been sad. Oh, really sad.
I would have been so irritated at that.
The strength and depth of the England squad is fabled, isn't it? But I think it's really interesting. Like I pick a team of the week as well, and I actually thought yesterday.
I sometimes copy off
Ali's. We do look at each other. We have messages to each other.
A little bit of a look, just in case.
I did look at yours. I think 2 weeks ago we had a few. I think as long as we're always the same 10, I feel okay. Because if she knows anything, she knows who the best 10 is. We'd had the same 10 this week, but I think it's the first time ever, because we've been doing this for years, that she's not been in any conversation about that because of she hasn't been playing every week, and that's unusual. But how good for England that she's at the stage of her career, which is different, as you say, and the, you know, the kind of profile of managing her body and so on, that they have an incredible pool of centres, that they're not in a place where they're like, we have to start her every single game. Yeah. They don't have to do that now. They can manage her in a way that is not detrimental to the team. So I think what will be really interesting is when they're all fit and ready and they play New Zealand, say, or France, who they pick. That'll be fascinating. And that, I guess that's the point where you're like, what is it she wants and what she wants to do?
It's time for our High Flyer of the Week segment, brought to you by our good friends at British Airways. On our social, we gave you the option of the following three players. Ili Kildan, now top meters carried, 791.7. Abby Dow is on 398.5. She's number two, just to give you an idea of how far ahead Ili is there. Top meters gained, 639.5. Abby number two is on 311. And top line breaks, 13. Abby is number two there with 8. It's just wild. Other nominees for the High Flyer of the Week category is Abby Dow, hat trick, same as Ellie. All of those line breaks and meters numbers are objectively viewed very, very good. I mean, she is ahead of the pack outside of Ellie, who now seems to be in her own category in many ways. And then our other High Flyer of the Week nominee, Meg Jones. What a fun day to just watch. If you just watched Meg all day, you would have had a great experience at that game, even if you didn't support any of the teams, because she just did so many outrageously great and fun and daring. And this is just the Meg Jones way of playing rugby. If you guys could have a vote here, could you look past Ellie, Abby?
Do you know what? I really did enjoy watching Meg play. I think she's really making that 13 her shirt her own. So just for a point of difference, yes, I do think I'd probably go for Meg. My favourite moment in the match actually was the point where she pushed Zoe Oldcroft over the line for her try.
Yay!
Where she was chasing them, which was lovely. So yeah, just for a point of difference, because we know what Ellie is doing, and that's the expectation now. Her yes. her biggest problem is maintaining it.
Yeah.
But a lot of what Ellie is doing is from the work around her, and one of the people working around her is certainly Meg Jones.
Meg, definitely.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Meg Jones. As you just said, her skill set under pressure, she's a special player, isn't she? Mm. I'd still go Ellie, in part because she's always been very good, but she's just gone to this kind of sensational level. And, you know, we're only a few games into the year in terms of Test Rugby. To build on it every game, I think, is just so special. And she is one, I always describe like lean forward players. So players who get the ball and you lean forward in your seat. She is one of the very few players in the world who is in that category for me. And I've already told you this story before, but there was a, in the group we were in, my friend Will, his 9-year-old daughter, Eliza, she just said, I want to be Ellie Kildon. And I just thought, well, this is what all of this is for. You know, this is why we're here. It's just magic. And so for me, I love watching her. I think she's sensational.
I totally agree. And you guys might correct me if I'm wrong, but sometimes in women's rugby, we almost want to not go after and not celebrate. If this is Anton DuPont, we are raving about it and nobody gets close. Sometimes in women's rugby, we're like, oh, we need to like bring her back and encourage somebody else to be closer. This girl is on fire. Them numbers are sensational. And if you watch her play, everything she touches at the moment turns to gold. So I'm in the Ellie Kildon corner. And I think, look, if she's going well, it is up to everybody else to go and get after her.
And someone like Meg is definitely the kind of competitive player who looks at the way Ellie is playing and going, I need to chase that target down. This is where we need to be. So I'm so here for Ellie setting the standards. Our High Flyer of the Week is, again, Ellie Kildon. Thanks again to our friends at British Airways. To get inspired for your next adventure, head over to ba.com. Now, if you saw the anthems on Saturday at Twickenham, you would have seen, firstly, Meg Jones at the end of the anthems going, yeah, into the camera. But there was also a really beautiful, heartfelt moment in Aaron Budd, the mascot at the game at the weekend, who stole everyone's heart because of her singing that anthem with so much dedication and passion. And she was serious about it. It was a moment that she was there for. She turned up to it and she stole the show. She was diagnosed with a terminal brain tumor on March 21st this year. She's 6 years old, and she was over the moon to be there with Marley Packer, her favorite player. And since her diagnosis, her family and friends have really set out to make sure that she has all of the experiences that she wants and to make her smile every day. Her dad, Chris, got in touch with us and asked if we could share their Just Giving page, which we will, to help fund her experiences. We'll pop the link in the description of the show below in case you'd like to donate. I know you guys spoke about it in commentary as well. And it was just beautiful to see her taking that moment the way she did. It's really important.
Yeah, it's one of those moments actually when you actually have to talk about something in live broadcast, and even you talking about it now, particularly when you've got children, that is a massive thing for them and their family going through. So if anyone can support them, I'd really suggest that you go out there. Moulton Mowbray Rugby Club, I think, is also supporting them as well. So anything you can do would be great.
Yeah, lovely. Now, we do need to talk about Ireland. Now that we've given England their little moment in the sun, Ali, the improvement on Ireland has been so real that in the pre-match show that we did, the Cabbage Patch, we spoke about Ireland so much. Someone said to me afterwards, I was surprised about how much we spoke about Ireland. But they have been the story, you know, like they have been absolutely phenomenal. how do you now reflect on the journey they've been on this championship?
Yeah, look, I think it was almost frustrating to have to play England after that Wales performance, because there was never going to be an opportunity to build on the Wales game, because you had England next at Twickenham, big wide open pitch, dry day, everything suited England, right? You know, just before the France game, it was disastrous timing in some ways. I think they have to just forget about it. Honestly, I hope they don't even dwell too much in their analysis this week on the game, because there's nothing to be gained from it. They were overwhelmed defensively, their inexperience told, the fact that program's been through the ringer in the last few years and is just coming out the other side. The good thing is the game against Scotland's huge. The fixtures this weekend are the best combined fixtures of the whole tournament. We can beat Scotland. Ireland can beat Scotland. I think Scotland are excellent, and I hope we do talk about them, and I really rate what they're doing. But on the basis of what we saw against Wales and a bit against Italy, this is an Ireland team with a big future. They almost just have to move, like, close the book on the England game. Come back to that later, because I think it is important for them to look at the programme and what's happening here as something to aim at, but it's not going to do them any good this week because, you know, so much went wrong. And I think if I rewatched the game for my sins, because I had to do something with Irish media on Monday, and we were, you know, it's total systems failure, you know, defensively. They were overwhelmed completely. And once the try started to come in, it would have been 100 if the game went on for another few minutes. So there is potential in that team. There are good young players in that team, but God, that was a steep learning curve.
And don't you think, retrospectively looking back, as much as that was an amazing performance by Ireland when they beat Wales, great result, but going from a game where you've predominantly been in attack for nearly the whole game to going into a game against England where they were defending permanently, it was just like the wrong combination of back-to-back fixtures for them to build on.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think also speed of ball. So in any of the other games, Ireland wouldn't have faced that defensively, because I agree there's some really bad defensive reads that got themselves into a point where you're trying to do something and actually would have been better just giving yourself a moment, because it would have been a bit clearer. But I think speed of ball was what caused Ireland a lot of problems, and that is a problem for the other teams facing England wherever you face them. Nobody else in the tournament, even France, don't play as quickly as England are playing under John Mitchell. So your time to think, to decide, to move is so cut down that even in training, you can't replicate that. So your prep is always at a disadvantage. And I think, like you say, you're totally right. Came at a dreadful point for Ireland, having had such a high, and really to say, look, we've moved on. Look at the team we can be, to then have this kind of bad placed England game.
Yeah. And I don't know, Katie, if you would agree, but do you remember when New Zealand were like in their pomp and everybody was kind of afraid of them? There was maybe not England, but most other teams, there was a kind of sense that when you played against this big line of black jerseys that you were beaten before kickoff. I think that is happening a little bit with England now. Ireland certainly looked overwhelmed from the kickoff, and if you watch the Scotland game the week before, I think that was their worst performance of the tournament, because there's the pace at which England are putting on the game is quite scary for a defensive system that maybe hasn't been tested in that way yet.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's that mentality, isn't it? Like, you look at the little errors that come in. Lauren Delaney dropped an early high ball. Moments where you really, really need to be clinical. Is it, like you say, that England factor? You just start to have a little glance if somebody's coming,
yeah,
and it just forces an error, and then you just compound your problems. And I totally agree. I think England have this massive shift in terms of how they're being perceived by other countries that we've only previously seen New Zealand have.
How do you prep your defensive system for that, though?
Yeah, really difficult, because I think not only have you got to prep your defensive system for it, and we hadn't seen the attack as good or as smooth as that. So what they would have been watching was slightly different to the pictures that were then being drawn in front of them at Twickenham. I think one of the things that does happen, though, when you're under that defensive pressure is your decision making can go out the window. And like the best example I could give you of that is just before half time, Ireland had leaked 5-6 tries. Get the ball off the clocks in red, just kick the ball off the park. Dan O'Brien is the future of this Irish team. She's 20 years old. She keeps the ball alive, kicks the ball straight to Ellie Kildon. I mean, my head, I literally just England actually scored, but Meg Jones got pulled back for a forward pass. But I think it's that. It's trying to keep your cool when you're under massive pressure defensively to still make clear, you know, thoughtful decisions. And that fell away. I do think the experience is in the bank for Ireland now. And I'm showing my age here, but when I remember Lynn Cantwell will often talk about one of her first caps, England won 79-0. You know, that stayed with that team for a long time, and experience in the bank, maybe it will count in the future.
But added to that, to saying Dana O'Brien is 20 years old, you've got to look at the support systems that's also around her. Like Aoife Dalton, she had a good game. She actually carried a lot of ball. The problem is they're not going anywhere. Who's actually helping out O'Brien, who kicked the leather off that ball as much as she could? The problem is it wasn't going anywhere. And also Delaney at fullback, she wasn't really kicking it anywhere. So you're kind of relying on a 20-year-old to do a huge amount there all on her own. But she's 20, you know, she's got a long career.
100%. I think she was probably got 10 years before it took. I think I was over 30 before I really understood what it took to manage a game. So like you say, those moments, all it will do is accelerate her development, because the next time she watches that back, she thinks, look, the ones I got right were the ones that found grass, the ones that rolled into corners, that the ones I got wrong are the ones probably Ellie Kildon caught on the full. And if my game plan is to kick the ball early, yep, I need to manufacture, or my team around me need to manufacture a way to move that fullback, because actually just getting the ball and kicking to her at times did Ireland so much more damage than maybe if they had gone through a few more phases and just trying to change those pitches.
The last person you should be giving the ball to, I mean, genuinely, in the world of rugby right now, just keep Ellie out of the game and you're already in a much better place, genuinely. Now, speaking of individuals that we do need to talk about, Cliona Maloney, the girl who's been brought back from exile because she spoke out. What does that do in a team structure, Ali? And what's the story? So is she the person who will speak out if things ever turn bad again? Is that a lot of expectation to now put on her to be the conscience of this Irish setup?
Well, look, I think she's the symbol of change. You know, the fact that she's been brought back in. She has a good relationship with Scott. She, you know, she's been playing in the English system and she knows him. I mean, I think people forget that Ireland's kind of lowest point when the girl sent that letter to the government over the head of the union and said, you know, we don't trust the union to manage this program, was not even 3 years ago. And there are girls in this team who signed that letter. So both co-captains signed it, Linda Dugang signed it, several players still in the setup. So there's plenty of leadership there who I think will talk truth to power behind the scenes if needed. But I hope that we've kind of moved on from that being necessary. Mm. And I hope Cliona can just come in and play her rugby, because she's been punished enough. And she, you know, she's in her 30s now. She has lost, you know, several years of playing rugby for her country. So, but I think the fact that she's there is a sign that this program is moving on, and that there is kind of comfort with bringing back in players who may unfairly be considered disruptive, I think very unfairly. So hopefully that's a good sign that she's there. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised actually if she starts this weekend.
And can I just say, I appreciate Ireland have just had a really tough loss, so it's probably not been a great week to be a coach, but credit to Scott Beamond for clearly fighting for Cliona to get her back into that programme, because he's watched her play in the PWR and he knew that he needed her. And I'm sure there were probably some very uncomfortable conversations that he put himself on the line for to actually get her back. So that's fair play.
Because there could be residual resentment in that squad. Like, everyone else is celebrating this as like a moment of peace and reconciliation. And I mean, South Africa and Ireland have used rugby to do a lot of peace and reconciliation over the years. So I'm very au fait with this, but it is potentially also divisive.
Yeah, I don't think so, though. If you speak to some of the players, they found out a few days before she came, and my understanding is there was genuine excitement about bringing her back in, because there's a recognition that, one, all of this was quite unfair, and two, she's a brilliant player. And you want brilliant players in your team, and you want great players with experience coming back in. And we just lost that Italy, you know, it was just, yeah, we lost the Italy game. So she came back in for the Wales game. So I think the timing was good, and the sentiment, as far as I understand it, is really positive.
Would you put Cliona to start and Neve in the back row, Neve Jones?
Good question. Because she tackles very well. I mean, I think Cliona probably deserves a chance to start. I'm a big fan of Jones. She tackles brilliantly. Her lineups have been decent, not perfect.
Better than last year.
And our scrums have been really good, actually. Our set piece is decent, but I'd probably start this weekend in respect that you know, she deserves a go in the starting team. It'd be quite harsh on our back row to drop any of them. I think they maybe will have another opportunity to show a bit better. Aoife Wafer, I mean, she's been the find of the tournament. She tried her heart out at Twickenham, you know, but I think the experience was she only had one cap going. I mean, I think she's been, you know, phenomenal. One cap to go into this tournament. She's definitely been Ireland's best player. So give her another go. The co-captain's in the back row as well. Maybe Neve Jones, but I couldn't see him doing that.
So tell us more about Aoife Wafer.
She's been on the radar for people who know the system in Irish for a while.
Yeah.
She's got a younger sister as well coming through the system who everyone's raving about. And she's just, you know, Katie, there are some players who just take to it. They just get an international shirt on and they just go for it. Not everyone is like that. I mean, there's probably plenty of people in England who've done that, but she was phenomenal against Wales. I mean, unbelievable if you rewatch that. She was brilliant against Italy as well, but I think the England game, you know, she was chasing shadows, wasn't she?
A little bit. And I think for me, you talk about how great Ellie Kildon's been, but she would be up there as my player of the tournament. To have one cap in an Ireland side who has had the history that we've just talked about, to go as well as she went in that game against Wales, that was as important as it was, is such a marker as a one cap. You might have your first game and against a back row that Wales have always had a good row, Alex Callender in that mix. She kept Alex Callender pretty quiet and was by far the shining star for the Ireland side. So I think she's been a great find. And like you say, is taken to test rugby. Like she's been there for 10 years.
Yeah. Let's talk about the broader Irish picture. Their co-captains both play in top-of-the-table PWR clubs, Gloucester, Hartbury and Exeter. Some players play over in the PWR, but if they do, they can't have an Ireland contract. And then if they play at home, they don't have a league, the standard of the PWR. So it is a really tough decision for those girls to have to make that. If you could do anything to fix Irish women's rugby and the structure around these players, what would you do, Ali Donnelly?
Well, I think it's about making sure that we've got an environment where the daily training kind of environment for players is of high standard and high performance. And we don't have that currently. So I think the RFU just need to be clearer about the route to doing it. So, you know, I was thinking a lot of countries will say, oh, let's do what England are doing. But you can't really. Ireland is a very small country with a much smaller number of players and not the same value of investment. So for me, it's, I think the RFU have decided that their league, the All-Ireland League, is not the route to develop elite players. And that is clear. And that's more of a grassroots kind of entry point competition for them now. Whether that's right or wrong, people have different views on that, but that's clear. I think what we've got have to have now is semi-pro provinces. So that's the system by which the men's game kind of run the game. So the four provinces. But the problem we've got is the kind of pace of change around the Celtic Challenge competition, the potential URC, the potential, what's it called?
Champions Cup.
Yeah. It's not there yet. So what we've actually, you could see that system working for Ireland. You have four provinces and a semi-pro, maybe pro in the future setup. That's their daily training, high performance environment being fed up through the clubs. And then they play in these cross-border competitions, but those competitions don't exist yet. And the Celtic Challenge is they're playing against second string Wales and Scotland teams. So Ireland need a bit of time for these things to come to fruition. But in the interim, our players are just not in this kind of high performance training day to day, and they're not playing enough games in the way that the Welsh, Scottish and English players get here. So there's a time lag between what the RFU wants to do and where we're at now, which won't really help in the short term. If that makes sense.
Do you not think, though, that is, without, and I mean this with the greatest amount of respect, a bit of a union issue? There is, all the home nations are in the same place. Ultimately, probably France and England have the best league structure. So what do you need? You need your girls playing regularly.
Yep.
Granted, you need support.
Yep.
But in the short term, do you not just try and push them into those leagues? Get as many of your girls playing as regular as possible. Meanwhile, back at home, you are finding and you are building something that allows them eventually to bring them back home into those leagues. Like you say, whether it's a province, whether it's a Celtic Challenge. But at the moment, it's almost like we're punishing the players in this area and saying, look, you need to come home and make this work for us because this is what we want to do. Rather than saying, look, how good can you be if we give you the best resource and we'll work our model around the current group? Meanwhile, somebody's doing some really high level strategic planning behind the scenes to think in 5 years' time, it needs to look like this, or in 7 years' time. And actually all that does is bring the Six Nations up. We spoke about it. It gives us something to sell, something to talk about. We get a bit of jeopardy because ultimately one thing we know, all know sitting here, is we can't continue at this rate.
Yeah, no, 100%. But at the same time, you can't blame a union for wanting to have their players at home, right?
No.
What they aren't supplying, though, is the solution right now to keep them there. And I think, you know, that's a real problem for us, and that needs to be solved quickly. We can't rely on England to solve all our problems for us, you know? And what you're describing there is that's exactly what should be happening. But remember, like, you know, I said this somewhere else this week, the loss to England is in part due to the legacy of mismanagement of this programme, right?
Yeah, of
course. So this programme was mismanaged for a long time. You know, 10 years ago, Ireland were beating England, we're beating France. We stood still, and now we're catching up, but we're only catching up to where those teams were 5 years ago. You know, the game, I don't think, has been handled brilliantly in Ireland. So what you're describing is a lovely utopia, but those conversations haven't been happening. But I do think we're moving in a direction. And if you look at what's happening in Wales, I do think Ireland is further ahead in a strategic thinking around the setup there and the regions and so on. But yeah, it's just all too slow. And if England stood still, it would be fine. But they don't stand still, no. You know?
Now, if I were a sponsor, because, and obviously I'm going to always think about this from a commercial perspective, but if I were the people who would be pouring the money into, for example, those four club sides or your four province sides that you then feed into a potential future hypothetical URC system, if I'm the sponsor who needs to sign up to fund a Munster or a Leinster or a Connacht women's side, what I would want is certifiable superstars who are ready to attract back home. Once we put in the cash, we want to know that we're going to have three or four really good players and a certifiably interesting level of jeopardy across that URC system so that your games, interprovincial games, but also your games against an Edinburgh or against an Ospreys or against a Bulls Daisy side is interesting. So you do have to develop those stars elsewhere so that you can pull them back into your system as soon as the infrastructure is set up there. Where else are you going to grow them? At the moment, it is the PWR. It is the French League.
The only thing I'm going to say in all of this is there has to be minimum standards across the whole of the women's club structure. And I always look at why England women's rugby is where it's at. It's not actually to do with the England professional contracts at all. For me, it was when Nikki Ponsford, before she left the Rugby Football Union, she set up the PWR and they had their minimum standards. And every woman who walks into a club knows the bare minimum of what they're going to get. And you're not actually allowed to run a club unless you can meet those standards. You tender for it, don't you?
Yeah.
And if you don't meet them, they're not interested. They will turn you away. And that is more what we actually need to see now. It's less shooting for the stars. It's more like, it sounds terrible when I say the bare minimum, but there has to be a level that you will not go below anymore if you want to produce top players. And that's more what Ireland, Wales, Scotland actually need to be thinking about. Okay, we cannot go this low anymore. We need to be raising the bar. And where is that bar?
And it's that point, isn't it? What is the daily training environment that we can provide for players? And in Ireland, clearly they think the clubs, not enough clubs can provide that for them. Therefore, they're looking at provinces, which is the route they're taking for the men's game. But that it all comes down to that, doesn't it? Having enough games, having a high performance environment where there are minimum standards, and those things are still not there in Ireland anyway.
But we're sitting here going, we need to promote the game. We want it to get bigger and bigger. But are we going to get to a point where actually we have to stop because we just don't have the quality to promote anymore? We can talk about Celtic Challenge, we can talk about Six Nations. But at what point does that gap become unsellable almost?
Yeah, making it commercial is the hardest point. And I think you've actually hit the nail on the head there, Elma. But as I said, when it comes to somewhere like Wales, I'm not thinking about the contracts that the Welsh women are on. I'm thinking about the layer below them because they're the ones that are going to push, that are going to make that team better. So what are you actually providing for them that's going to make them achieve that level? Yeah. That's where you need that minimum standard, where a player who will be a dual career player, they're going to have another job. They might get a match fee and say maybe a bit of money for training. So we're talking about maybe a few hundred pounds a month, maybe something like that. Maybe pushing to 1,000 if you're lucky, unlikely though. But if you're pushing that kind of money, they're going to need another career. So bare minimum, they're going to need access to a physio. They're going to need access to good facilities. Depending on what their specialism in, they're going to need a specialist coach in there looking after them as well, depending on what position they play. Where is that line? And that, but it's not for the players above. This is for the players actually below.
Isn't there an argument that the visibility and profile of the women's game at elite level has gone faster than the infrastructure that supports it?
Yes.
100%. Do you know what I mean? It's like the game now has such scrutiny focused at the top end and no one really sorted out all the back end stuff. And this is why this debate's happening, isn't it?
Yeah, and also the back end is so far away from it. You're like, where do we start? So we have all these different options and where we need to go and where you need to spend this money and how much money you need to spend. But all we do know is that gap between, like you say, top end, middle and bottom is grassroots rugby is nowhere near. Even if you compare championship level rugby to PWR, which is only the league below, that gap in itself is absolutely enormous now.
Now, your work at More Than Equal is doing a lot of this kind of thing, but in motorsport. How much of what you've seen and learned through the hard yards you've put in, and Scrum Queens really is your side gig because it's not your real job that you've been doing since 2009.
You don't make any money on that, do you?
No, very, very little. Yeah, no, there's loads of parallels between rugby and motorsport because they're both male-dominated spaces.
Yeah.
So we did a big piece of research last year into there hasn't been a woman in Formula One for 50 years, right? Racing. Why hasn't this happened? This is one of the world's only mixed gender sports. What a great opportunity the sport's missing. So what are the barriers? And actually, when we came out with the results of that, all the barriers are the same as rugby. You know, opportunity to play, investment, visibility, outdated perceptions, and so on and so forth. So there are loads of parallels you can take from rugby into motorsport. I think where motorsport has an advantage over rugby is in terms of the commercial side of the sport. Like Formula One is a truly commercial beast, and it is geographically diverse in a way that rugby isn't. You know, I always say rugby's an international sport, Formula One's a global sport, and there's a difference between those two things. That said, I would say that rugby comes off well in terms of the conversation and quality of discussion it has about women in its sport. Motorsport's miles behind on that, and it's partly because, and Sarah, sorry, sporing for you, because we talked about this last week, at least in rugby, you've got, you know, we can retreat to our own space, you know, like the crowd, demographics, all very different. Women's rugby still has its own space it can play in. In motorsport, the girls have to like literally play in the same lane as the boys and conform to a system that wasn't really built for them. But I definitely take lots of things I've learned from rugby into that job. And the commercial piece is crucial to it.
It's really interesting. Katie, you're just shaking
literally
your head.
Fascinated.
You would have loved this.
How? Why motorsport? Or was it just a challenge of this?
Yeah, I think, look, I was a director at Sport England for a number of years and got the opportunity to work with a lot of sports, not motorsport, but I think my eyes were open to the kind of what was happening in, particularly in sports like football and netball and how they worked with women. And I think for me, you know, this is one of the last glass ceilings in sport in terms of performance, in that it's been such a long time since a woman competed in F1, and the growth of the sport. I mean, 45% of F1 fans are now female, largely due to the success of things like Drive to Survive. It's a sport which is ripe for growth. And I am a horse racing fan. And actually, if you look at someone like Rachel Blackmore, that's another mixed gender sport, winning the Grand National, we are starting to see like really interesting things happen in a mixed gender space. So I think for me, my motorsport knowledge was pretty low when I took this job. And that's partly why they hired me. And I've hired people, as you know, I walked into the job with no team. And I've hired a team, and one of the most central pieces of that jigsaw was a guy from British Cycling who we brought in because he'd built a pathway for men and women, you know, in the Olympic system. And so we don't have loads of motorsport experience, but I could talk about motorsport quite eloquently now, a year in. But it is really interesting because you've just got this piece where women and girls have come into a space. The equipment isn't designed for them. The system isn't designed for them, but they do present a big opportunity kind of commercially and kind of visibility wise for the sport.
And you've done this transitioning from working in government for Theresa May between 2017 and 2019.
As a civil servant, very important to say.
From deputy official spokesperson for the Prime Minister to the deep end of Formula One.
I don't know why Ali talks to me, honestly. I mean, there are just times where she's telling me a story about being like Japan with the ambassador. I'm just like, I don't understand what you're doing.
That is wild.
Yeah, no, look, my kind of take on jobs and stuff is like, if you do interesting things will happen. So that is the approach I take to jobs in my career, just to be in jobs that are interesting and, you know, can apply to the skill set that I have around communications and marketing, I guess. And I've just been lucky, you know, working at Number 10 was amazing. You know, one of the most interesting jobs I think anyone could ever do, but also completely unsustainable. I used to get up at 4:30, you know, every morning, and, you know, you get to bed at like 11, 12. And so moving into sport was a no-brainer for me. So, yeah.
Why move into sport outside of the demands of the job?
Well, because I guess I have two passions in life. Sorry, this is turning into a bit of a like...
this is my life.
You can cut a lot of this out. Like, I have two passions in life, politics and sport. And so I've always thought in my mind, those are the two areas I want to work in the most.
Yeah.
So I've done that in government. And now I'm at the bit of my career where I'm working in sport. That may not be forever. I may go back into government at some point. But why not? You know, if jobs are out there and they're interesting, why not take them?
Can I vote for you somewhere? Yes, please. Lead us, the Scrum Queens Party.
Do you know when it does get really good, though, is when you go out with Ali for a few drinks and then she talks about a job. Oh. That's where you get the really good stuff.
Obviously,
we can't talk with secrets. A microphone in front of us. That's when you get the really
Would
good
you
stuff.
Ever go to the IRU?
Or a few. Well, firstly, they'd never hire me. I think that is genuinely
so
true.
Cillian Maloney made her return from exile. Anything is possible.
No, I wouldn't.
No.
No, I think for me with rugby, like I've not worked in women's rugby like ever, partly deliberately because I like to be a bit on the outside and I like to be able to, I wouldn't say like throw stones, but like critique the sport and hold it to account. And I do have this genuine concern at the moment that the women's game is, it's in a very celebratory space and the kind of conversations that need to be had to hold the game to account and to put pressure on it in a positive way I'm worried those aren't happening at the rate they should be happening. And, you know, I look at things like World Rugby buying Rugby Pass, and, you know, so many journalists are writing for Rugby Pass now, and it's great. You know, it's a great content hub. But at the same time, it's owned by the International Federation for the Sport. And so certain conversations are never going to happen on there. But that's still one of the ways in which people get their news. So I think I'm better served outside the system.
Okay.
I do think, you know, one of the pleasures in being outside the system and not being beholden to people because you're independent, though, is you can quietly influence and lobby.
Yeah.
You know, I talk to everyone in the game all the time. They can take or leave my views, right? But I think that's quite fun for me.
I think that's really impressive. And I've seen it. You are... so powerful. Do not make any mistakes. Ali Donnelly might be the most powerful person in rugby that doesn't have an actual title in the sport outside of Scrum Queen.
She is the Scrum Queen.
She is the Queen. Now, speaking of royal efforts.
I'm definitely coming back. This is amazing.
I mean, it's basically the Ali Donnelly show. Yeah. We do need to give a moment here for Scotland, who have never gone to Italy and won there in the Women's Six Nations. 10-17, the result. Scotland 6th and Italy 7th in the world rankings, which is an exciting shift. Well matched. Dinka, amazing. Chloe Rolley, stunning. Jade Kunkel on commentary. Have really enjoyed her growing into that role. Producer Sharon and I were talking about her having that Philippa Tatiet kind of real time on the mic. You know, when she speaks, it's very considered. And that's beautiful. Unfortunately, Wales, France was a tough watch. 0-40 the score at the Cardiff Arms Park. Wales at the bottom of the table, just on 1 point, and now can only come joint bottom. Summed up by the commentary of Gareth Rhys-Owen at one point there, saying, what a mess. What a mess over the final try.
That's one of the most unnecessary tries I've ever seen in Test rugby, that try.
Yeah. Do you know what? I do want to give some credit for the Welsh Rugby Union for the changes that they've made. And this has been a difficult campaign. I'm not trying to defend that in any way, shape or form. But I look back at their games and I think actually when I watch them play now, they've got a much better shape than I've seen with them play before. In that game against France, look, they had loads of territory in possession and a couple of the French tries come from intercepts, which is just a loose pass out wide that has been taken on and they've jumped on. Another one comes from a counter. So I don't think they're in any way terrible in what they're doing. They do need to shake something up, but I don't think we're at a point with Welsh women's rugby that we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater and go through another crisis, because I've seen a Welsh crisis and this is not it. They just need to improve.
Okay, well, we're very excited to be heading over to Cardiff on Saturday. So if you're an English fan and you can't get to Bordeaux with everyone else who's going to be in Bordeaux in the bad weather, can you tell I'm a little jealous? We are going to head over to the Principality Stadium for that first ever freestanding game for the Women's International, Italy playing Wales. We are going to be doing a little live show beforehand. If you are coming, come join us at our pre-game warm-up with Philippa Tatiet and Gwen Crabb. Tickets are on sale. Children can join us for free and students half price. Come on, come all. The Chasing Pack is the topic of this Women's Six Nations. It is the one that has thrown up the biggest number of curveballs, and there is real opportunity here. Third spot guarantees qualification, Rugby World Cup 25.
The battle for third is big.
Yeah.
It's significant. And I think the fact that Ireland can still finish third, having just leaked nearly 90 points, actually just reminds you of the gulf now between this two-tier tournament. But yeah, no, these games are, there's a lot riding on these games.
Yeah, and third place, I'm still confused if it's going to be good for the team that finishes there or not, particularly after what we've seen from Wales in this campaign, of what their reaction to being in WXV1 has actually done for them. I hope if it is, say, a Scotland or an Ireland, if they end up in WXV1, that they can really learn from that experience. I don't really think Wales learned a lot. I do think Scotland had a great boost off being in WXV2. So as I said, there's still a lot to come from the whole WXV experience. But ultimately, I think we all know if you work in women's rugby circles, where you end up in WXV isn't actually that important. It's qualifying for that World Cup. And we're pretty sure that even if you finish sixth in the Six Nations, you're still going to qualify
for
that World
Cup. How many voice notes have we exchanged about?
A lot.
About qualification.
But could Ireland realistically go from WXV3 to WXV1 and get something out of that?
I think it'll be way too soon, frankly.
I don't think it would help. I really don't. I think if you're building particularly towards that World Cup in 2025, I think it could be a disadvantage whichever team ends up in WXV1, potentially.
I totally agree. And I wonder, actually, if WXV was all around giving teams the opportunity to play, then surely somebody thinks, actually, what is the best for these teams? Because I agree, it did nothing for Wales. Scotland are probably your best side to go to WXV1 out of the ones available. Ireland going there would be absolutely dreadful for them. Absolutely dreadful. All we're going to see is a big score. So if you're World Rugby, would you look at how...
I think they are. I think we expect WXV to change.
It's going to completely evolve off the back of the World Cup,
Which is great, and it's the right thing to do. But again, everything just takes so much time. I'm like, come on.
But then on the flip side, and something we have said is that I don't want this to be a really negative WXV discussion, because what WXV has provided is regular fixtures in the window that the women previously didn't have. So yes, the structure is not perfect, but it still exists, and that's important.
And Italy are still in the fight for a WXV1 spot. Do not discount them. They are going to Wales with that carrot dangling ahead of them. 12:15 on Saturday. Plenty there for them to play for. They will be absolutely fired up for this opportunity, having seen what France went to Cardiff and did over the weekend.
And Italy were good, actually. I mean, I think Scotland, they were best. They deserved the win, but it was very tight. It could have gone either way.
Wales can only finish as high as fifth if they beat Italy by more than 7 points. Italy, Ireland and Scotland are the ones in the running for WXV1. Ireland playing Scotland at Kingspan Stadium in Belfast. What does that mean for this team? Ireland are in the running, but Sam Monaghan is going to be back, we're hoping.
Yeah, it looks like it, yep.
Good. They failed to qualify for the last World Cup. How much of that is still in their rearview mirror?
Look, the squad has changed so much. I wonder if it's a discussion point for them. It would take something spectacular for them not to qualify at all, actually, the way it's working now with the 16 teams. So I don't think that's the looming factor. But I do think this is a huge game for them because of what happened last weekend and because we failed to build on the Wales momentum. So it's a big, big game, but I'm not sure if it's because of World Cup qualification.
And you look at Scotland, they seem to be winning away from home. Mm. You know, I know they had England and France at home, but they've clearly really focused on those three away games. And why wouldn't they go and finish the triple?
If Ireland beats Scotland and Italy lose or draw, then they'll get third. Now, Scotland will know that outcome of the Welsh game when this Ireland-Scotland game kicks off, and they'll know what they need to chase to secure that Rugby World Cup spot. These are girls who will still tell you about the bad memories, borderline PTSD they have from qualifying for the previous World Cup and what a process that was and how many times they thought they had it and then they didn't. So for Scotland, this is still a very recent memory and something that looms large on their to-do list. Also, who wouldn't want to see Scotland take on Joe Yap's Wallaroos, who has a partnership deal with Cadbury's that was recently announced? There's plenty there for us to get excited about, potentially WXV1. France, England, 4:45 p.m. in Bordeaux. You guys will be there. I know you will. You're smiling broadly.
I'm mostly excited about the train ride on my own. No children, no people.
What are you going to do?
I have two books picked out and several podcasts downloaded. I can't wait. Probably scroll my phone the whole way. But you know, I have a plan.
So now, England coming into this looking great, absolutely on song. France have scored a 14-0 win over Wales. But how much can they really take from that game? Because what is it that you can do to prepare for this England team?
Can I just say, this is France's opportunity. I don't want anyone thinking that England are going to turn up and just automatically win a Grand Slam. That is not going to happen. We've been told already this morning it's going to be a record crowd in France. Mm-hmm. France have not beaten England now since 2018. And England switched off in the second half last year. Had that game gone to 85 minutes at Twickenham, France would have won it. It's whether they can keep their composure for a whole 80 minutes. I think if they can beat England. And I hope for the tournament that it's tight.
I think Ali touched on it as well, because I definitely think, and haven't played in some of those games, England have over France what New Zealand have had previously over England. That can they close a game out? Can they? Because there's been many a game that's been within one score, but it's generally always gone England's way. I think what's different though is France and France are such a different beast to what you see France away.
And if you look at the log at the moment, England on 20 points, France on 19. England, in terms of tries against, have 2 against them, France 5. Tries for, England 38, France 19. That's exactly double. Points difference, England 208, France 94. What do you make of these stats?
I think for me, you're right about what France offer. The problem that I think French rugby has is whether they are accurate with possession.
Definitely.
I think if they are cheap with the ball and they throw these offloads, like we've seen against all either sides, the form that Ellie Kildearn, Abby Dow, Meg Jones are in, England will capitalise on that. And I think if France are just a fraction, I don't think they need to go away from their DNA, just need to be a little bit more respectful of the ball, then I think you're right, we could be in for a really, really tight, close game.
I think they've been very careless with the ball. That's exactly right. But they haven't needed, like the 14-0 game, they didn't have to do very much.
No.
They picked off 2 bad passes and they executed a couple of good moves. I, on paper and on performance so far, I just can't see France winning, despite all the variables you've thrown in, which is big
trying
crowd.
To add jeopardy,
big crowd. I'm not English, right? So big crowd and all of that. That is a factor. But if you watch both teams, I've watched all the games of both teams, they're way off this England team in terms of their ability to turn possession into points.
Yeah.
The one thing I'd say about France that has been great though is they celebrate each game like they've won 500-0.
Oh yeah.
They seem to really enjoy each other's company. They all talk up the coaching philosophy, whether they believe it or not, I don't know, but like there's something that they seem to get on, and that, you know, if it's tight, if they manage to keep it tight, those things do often matter, right?
Yeah.
So maybe I just can't see it.
All of the rest of the rugby will be done by then, and then this will be the big decider. Super Saturday. What a great opportunity for us. Are you going to give us a score prediction there then?
Come, Katie Daly. For England, France?
Yes.
I think England will put 40 on France. 40.
She's gone big.
Yeah. Ali Donnelly gave me the side eye.
Well, I think, honestly, if England turn up like they did against Ireland, I don't think, regardless of the France we get, I think they are capable of scoring 40. So I'm going to go 40-17 England.
And who's getting third?
Oh.
Make a call. Come
Italy.
On. Ooh.
Ooh. I think Italy have got the best chance. I think Italy, Scotland, Ireland could be closer.
Yeah,
so I think Italy could do a job if they play like the bits we've seen over the tournament against Wales.
Who gets there?
To be fair, I thought you were saying they were going to beat them by 40, which is why I gave you the side eye.
They're going to score some more.
I think England will win by at least 10 plus. I think Scotland will finish third because I think they've got the ability to close games out. They've learned that and they built that. So yeah, England to win, I think comfortably, honestly, I do. And then Scotland to finish third.
Wales wooden spoon?
Sadly, yeah. As I said, don't get too down on Wales. I really don't want everyone to, but I do know something has to change, and that's more for the likes of a Nigel Walker and Abby Tierney to go in and try and figure out what needs tinkering than the players to actually be too concerned about. But yes, I would say Italy to win, but I don't know, there's something about Scotland. I think they might nick it.
I think they might win.
I think it might be Scotland that nick that third. We shall see. And I think England, yeah, I think they are going to win, but I think it's going to be tighter than everyone thinks because it's also raining. Do check your weather forecast. It looked pretty horrible actually when we kick off, so I think it's going to be within 5.
Is that why
within
you put
5? Wow.
Is that why you put the weather forecast on the top of the group?
That is correct, yes. It's actually quite nice when we land on the Friday. Bit overcast, but yeah, pretty much the whole of the Saturday it's raining.
Oh
God, massively affects my outfit choice, that does.
Take the wellies then. There we go.
Big hat.
Yeah, something to keep the rain out. Big thank you, Ali Donnelly and Sarah Orchard, for joining us in this very special episode.
Pleasure.
It's been great to have both of you and all of your very informed opinions on this couch to really bring some sense to the conversation. And then a special moment to our steering wheel. The generosity of spirit that you have brought to this little
stint. It's like a backhanded compliment.
This is all I get.
But I've just heard
about you.
You
are rubbish, but
thanks for coming.
Yeah.
I know, you tried your best.
You held a grudge against Sarah Orchard, who's genuinely the nicest, most everyone is welcome person in all of rugby.
Can you imagine how I feel towards you?
I am genuinely worried now. But that also makes me feel very lucky for how you've turned up with a smile every time.
It's because I like Shira.
And you are so nice to Shira, and we really appreciate you for that. Shira says she's not, but she keeps smiling. Anyway, thank you very much.
No, it's been a total pleasure.
It's been so good to have you. So thank you so much for coming on board. We have been the Good, the Scars, and the Rugby. We will bring Scars with us next week in partnership with our friends from Vodafone, which we're very excited. The Mosef, Mario, will also be back.
Emily Scarrett and Natasha Hunt.
Emily Scarrett and Natasha Hunt, as they are known. I mean, at this stage, sometimes I'm really stunned by the fact that they do have actual real first names. Emily and Natasha, whoever they might be, will also be back. We are the Good, the Scars, and the Rugby, a Folding Pocket production produced by our fearless leader, Shira Kilgallen.
You've been listening to The Good, The Scars and The Rugby. A bit like Loose Women, but with less emphasis on working on your pelvic floor.
The Scrum Queen.
She is the queen. Now, speaking of...